I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last week, South Korean President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un crossed the demilitarized zone and shook hands for the first time. This was the start of their historic summit, where Kim said he would give up his nuclear weapons program for concessions from the United States. President Trump has said he will meet with Kim to make a deal. Next Saturday is the deadline for the U.S. to reauthorize the agreement negotiated by the Obama administration and our allies to halt Iran's nuclear weapons program, something Trump has called the worst deal the country ever made. A top Iranian official said there is no deal without the United States. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave a PowerPoint presentation this Monday about what he called evidence of a secret Iranian nuclear weapons program based on documents taken from a military compound in Iran by the Mossad.
We're going to show you Iran's secret nuclear files. You may well know that Iran's leaders repeatedly denied ever pursuing nuclear weapons. Well, tonight I'm here to tell you one thing. Iran lied.
Today in Radio Times, we're going to look at these two regions and the deals that are on the table. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Dominic Tierney. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Swarthmore College. He's a Templeton Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and he's a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Dominic Tierney, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure to be here.
And joining us by telephone is Bobby Ghosh. He's a journalist and commentator. He's written for Quartz, CNN, and he was the Baghdad bureau chief for Time. In fact, he was one of our go-to reporters during the Iraq War. Bobby Ghosh, it's been a long time. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well. Are you there, Bobby Ghosh?
Yes, I am. It's great to be back.
Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Well, let's start with Iran. Let's start with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and this PowerPoint presentation that he gave on Monday. Dominic, I'll start with you, but Bobby, we'll get you in real quick. Was this a smoking gun? Did he have evidence that Iran was somehow violating this agreement?
Well, Netanyahu made this this very dramatic presentation. There were files on stage. He was sort of a master showman. And he was speaking to two audiences. The first was the global audience, and the second was an audience of one, that is President Donald Trump. And, of course, the timing is no coincidence. He is trying to get Trump to tear up the Iran nuclear deal. Bibi has long been a critic of the deal. And so he claimed that Iran has a history of lying. It cannot be trusted. And therefore, this deal is a sham and is very dangerous. Is it a smoking gun? Well, I would say if it is, the smoke has dissipated a long time ago, because the real details of Iran lying here really go back to 2003. There was nothing dramatically new in Bibi Netanyahu's presentation. Instead, he reconfirmed what we already know, which is that up until 2003, Iran had an active nuclear weapons program, which it was not honest about. Then from 2003 to 2009, there is some evidence of continued nuclear activities. But after 2009, according to the IAEA, there's no real evidence that Iran has continued with an active nuclear weapons program. So the smoking gun, if it exists, is really about the early 2000s.
Bobby, it's interesting that Benjamin Netanyahu spoke in English. I don't think typically happen when he's speaking to the Israelis or the Israeli government. Do you agree with Dominic that it was really aimed at the President of the United States?
Yes, I think that's fairly clear. I think he was reminding the President of the United States, because we know that he had already spoken to Donald Trump about this when the two men met, I think in February, that he handed over some of the evidence that the Mossad had uncovered. So he was reminding the President at a crucial moment about a week before push comes to shove on sort of the President signing off on the deal. It is very clear that that's who his real audience was. The rest of the world, for the rest of the world, this is not news. The entire negotiations of the nuclear deal was conducted on the assumption that, despite their denials, that Iran had been pursuing nuclear weapons. You know, there's an academic interest in the documentation that has been unveiled. It shows unambiguously that Iran had been lying. But you know what? We already thought they were lying. We pretty much knew they were lying. And the whole point of the negotiations was to make sure that they can't lie again about this one thing in the future, that there was a verification process that to make sure that this kind of lying does not take place.
Well, interestingly, there was for a moment a typo coming out of the White House, the word has as opposed to had Bobby Ghosh, which obviously is a very different way of talking about what Iran is or isn't doing. Do you think the president will pull out of this deal? Is there any way to know that?
Well, he has given every indication that he wants to pull out of the deal. If this is a very hard president to sort of anticipate his next move, because he enjoys keeping people guessing. That is part of his technique, both politically and diplomatically. So, and he always gives himself the room to change his mind in the last minute, and there seems to be no real political consequence to his changing his mind at the last minute. All that having been said, he has given every indication that he wants to pull out of the deal. He has repeatedly said, as you said at the top of the segment, that this is the worst deal that the United States ever made. He had both presidents of France and the Chancellor of Germany come by and try to change his mind. He had opportunities in their presence to say, okay, these people have persuaded me, so I'm going to give it another 6 months. He chose not to take those opportunities. So if we are to believe his words and believe his body language, if you like, yeah, I think he wants to pull out of the deal.
And Dominic, it's not just the United States and Iran. There are other countries involved in this deal. Let's say the U.S., the president, does pull out of the deal. What happens to the deal? And I quoted top Iranian official saying, without the United States, there is no, without the United States, there is no deal. And he also seemed to say, and we're going to go back to doing what we did before the deal. Is that a risk, do you think?
It's absolutely a risk. So the nuclear deal was not simply negotiated between the United States and Iran. It was negotiated between the Iran and what is called the P5 plus one, the permanent members of the Security Council, along with Germany, also sometimes mentioned as the European Union, essentially. And so in those other countries, the Iran nuclear deal is simply not controversial. There is broad support for it in Europe. So what happens if the United States unilaterally reneges on the deal? We don't know, but we can say for sure that Iran will make hay out of this, and the United States will have achieved something extraordinary, which is it will make Iran appear to be the upholder of international treaties and international law. Even as it is a state which has, you know, has a terrible human rights record and so on. And equally dangerously, or more dangerously, it could drive an absolute wedge between the United States and its European allies. If the U.S. reintroduces sanctions, it is not clear that the Europeans will follow suit. In fact, the Europeans may refuse to comply or cooperate with U.S. sanctions and may try to keep the Iran deal going in some shape or form. And that would be potentially catastrophic for the sort of U.S. alliance, U.S. global order. And what will Iran do? Well, I think Iran will not suddenly turn all of its centrifuges back on. But it is, of course, almost certain to respond in some way. For example, it might limit inspections or cut off inspections for a time, or do some other activity that that it's currently prohibited from doing. So the repercussions would be very dangerous.
Bobby, you have called this a bad deal, and you're not the only one that has called it a bad deal, but it is the deal that we have. Do you think there's an opportunity after a couple of years to have these parties sit around and try to negotiate or renegotiate a better deal?
The Iranians have made it very clear that they've made the deal they're going to make, and that they're not inclined to renegotiate anything. I don't think the deal itself is a bad deal. It's a pretty good deal under the circumstances. But I think the circumstances were deeply flawed. I think the deal ought not to have been made when it was. But there's no point crying over spilt milk here. I think there was an opportunity for President Obama and President Bush before him to press the Iranians to negotiate on a much broader framework, that not only to stop the nuclear program, but also to stop other bad actions by Iran. The analogy I used when the deal was made, when I wrote about it, was that what we've done here is that we've taken, if you imagine a neighborhood of nations, and one person in this neighborhood is a murderer, a rapist, a burglar, a carjacker, and a whole bunch of other things besides all. And we made a deal with this person that we'll overlook all these other things as long as you promise not to be an arsonist as well. That was the analogy I used at the time. I still believe that was to be the case, and that by focusing only on the nuclear deal, we've put ourselves in a position, the world has put itself in a position where it's less able to act on Iran's other bad actions. But when countries make deals, and especially when it's a deal that involves, as Professor Tierney pointed out, five other important nations, when a deal like that is made, then you have to keep your end of the bargain. That's the whole point of being a responsible member of the global community of nations. And it would make a very, very bad precedent if the United States were to pull out. I think that if the U.S. were to pull out and were to exercise a great deal of diplomatic capital, I can imagine a situation where the Europeans, kicking, screaming, reluctantly, went along with the U.S.
Really?
But my concern, just about. But my concern is that China, Russia, would be much less constrained by American interests here. The only way to get all the other signatories of the deal to go along with the United States would be to essentially threaten them that if your companies and if your countries did business with Iran after we pull out, then these sanctions would also hurt your company. So if you're a Chinese company, a Russian company, a German company, if you do business with the Iranians after we pull out of the deal, then your companies will face consequences as a result. If the United States essentially then blackmail the rest of the world to go along, that would be the only way Trump could make this work. And who wants to see that? Who wants to see the United States blackmailing its allies and the rest of the world?
Sure. Well, let's take a very short break and we'll pick up on that. I know our other guest wants to respond as well. That's Bobby Ghosh. He's a journalist and commentator. Also with us, Dominic Tierney, associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College. We're talking about the Iran nuclear deal and the fact that there's a deadline a little more than a week away about whether the U.S. will or not reauthorize it. We're also going to be talking about North Korea. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Dominic Tierney of Swarthmore College and journalist Bobby Ghosh about two simultaneous nuclear negotiations taking place, one involving Iran and one involving North Korea. Let me play something that President Trump said speaking to reporters, and this is about the Iran deal and the deadline.
Prime Minister Netanyahu just gave a very, I don't know if everybody's seen it, but I got to see a little bit of it. And that is just not an acceptable situation. And I've been saying that's happening. They're not sitting back idly. They're setting off missiles, which they say are for television purposes. I don't think so. So we'll see what happens. I'm not telling you what I'm doing, but a lot of people think they know. And on or before the 12th, we'll make a decision.
You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tell us whether you think the U.S. should stay in or get out of the Iran deal. You made a face, I have to say, Dominic Tierney. Bobby Ghosh was talking about if we pull out, we could potentially blackmail other countries, other companies that do business with Iran. Does that seem like good policy? And I'm not sure even Bobby Ghosh thinks it's good policy, but I guess it is an option.
Well, The United States could try to do that, and the consequences would be very severe for global alliance. The U.S. actually has some history on this point. Back in 1996, the U.S. tried to use exactly that kind of leverage against foreign businesses to stop them from doing business with Iran and Libya. And what happened is the European Union actually refused to cooperate, and there was actually a real schism between the two. So the Europeans, unsurprisingly, are not going to take kindly to that kind of economic blackmail. After all, just ask yourself, what would Americans do if the European Union passed legislation saying we will punish American companies that don't do what we want? I think instinctively American companies and the U.S. government would say, well, we're not going to, you know, follow your pressure. And so other countries, especially powerful actors like the EU, can be expected to act in the same way.
Bobby, are the sanctions, how I guess, draconian are they, and how effective do you think they have been in all these negotiations?
Well, they were pretty. They were effective to the extent that they brought the Iranians to a negotiating table. There are different interpretations to how harsh they were. Could they have been harsher? What would be the consequences of that? Countries always have one more quiver in their bow when it comes to sanctions. You know, I traveled to Iran a couple of years ago, and people didn't seem particular. I didn't feel that there was anything particularly lacking in the markets in Tehran that the sanctions were preventing the Iranians from getting their hands on. You could buy anything in Iran that you pretty much wanted. Now, there was a premium attached to everything because a lot of things that were covered under sanctions would be smuggled into the country, and you had to pay more for them. So I also traveled to Iraq during the Saddam Hussein era when there were sanctions against Saddam. Those sanctions, at least as a outsider could perceive the impact, those sanctions seem to have been much, much stronger. The sanctions in North Korea, clearly, much stronger than they had been on Iran. But Iran is a large country, has a very solid economic base of its own. It has a much greater capacity to endure economic pain and overcome or at least live with a certain regime of sanctions. So, look, could they have been harsher? They could absolutely have been harsher. Would that have worked? I'm skeptical about that.
Dominic and I were talking about this during the break, the fact that, I'm not sure what the word is, I'll say ironic, that Netanyahu is pointing out this secret, what he called a secret Iranian nuclear program, when Israel has its own secret nuclear program. Dominic, you want to speak to that?
Sure. So not everyone is necessarily aware of the details of this, but Israel began its nuclear weapons program many decades ago and developed a nuclear weapon in the late 60s, early 70s. Since that time, it has built up a pretty powerful arsenal, most likely several hundred nuclear weapons. Israel, however, is not a declared nuclear power, so it has not officially come out as a nuclear power. And if you ask Israeli officials about the nuclear weapons program, they always respond with the same phrase. They say Israel will not be the first country to introduce nuclear weapons into the Middle East. And if you ask them about it, they just repeat the phrase.
What do they mean by that?
Well, it's one of these examples in international relations of deliberate ambiguity, right? So what they mean by that is essentially, wink, wink, yes, we have nuclear weapons, because, of course, they would like to deter their adversaries, of whom there are many in the Middle East historically. But the reason it's not official is in part to keep the United States on board. Mm. The U.S. does not want Israel to come out as an explicit nuclear power. That would be very problematic given the broader non-proliferation treaty and efforts at non-proliferation that U.S. has been pushing globally. So everyone can sort of live with this ambiguity. But the truth of the matter is that Israel has an extraordinarily powerful nuclear arsenal.
Bobby Ghosh, we could do a whole hour on this. You covered the Iraq war. You were Baghdad bureau chief for Time magazine. Did the war, the U.S.-led war in Iraq, empower Iran?
Oh, yeah. I think there's no question about that. We saw that happen. I saw that take place in real time, within days of the fall of Saddam Hussein. You know, you remember the statue coming down. Yep. There were Iranian speakers in Baghdad, and the political elite that now rules in Iraq, a very, very large part of that political elite, has strong ties to Iran, has strong ties to the Iranian regime. Many of the senior political leaders of Iraq spent many years in exile living in Iran. So, yeah, there's no question that Iran came out, feeling less threatened by its traditional enemy, Iraq, and B, much more able to influence what was taking place in Iraq. And a lot of what you see in Iraq's Iran's behavior in Syria, in Yemen, and reflects the freedom that the war in Iraq has given the regime in Iran to stretch their arms, so to speak.
Dominic, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think Bobby offers a very useful analysis there. But there's actually a bigger story here, which is that Iran is supposedly America's major rival in the Middle East. And yet if you look at the last 20 years, time and again, the United States has taken actions which have dramatically improved Iran's strategic position. So we removed the Taliban in 2001. That was one of Iran's enemies at the time, on which is Afghanistan borders Iran. Then we removed Iran's nemesis, Saddam Hussein, and Iraq today is a client state of Iran. Then we went to war against ISIS, another enemy of Iran. Now we're about to potentially tear up the nuclear deal, which I think would actually potentially be another boon to Iran in terms of its showdown with the United States. So there's a bigger story here, which is the U.S. is almost always aiding the Iranian strategic position. So there's something problematic there.
Let me get, looks like Brian from Havertown to join our conversation. And Brian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As I understand it, one of the benefits of the agreement to Iran was that it received money that was frozen in U.S. and European bank accounts, I guess, from the Iranian Revolution. And it was some billions of dollars. And it was something that Iran desired greatly. They have, as I understand it, already received it. So not to be too pragmatic, but if we've already given Iran a lot of what it wants in exchange for things that we want from Iran, it's just not at all clear to me why we would tear up the deal.
Well, that's a really interesting question, Brian. Let me toss that first to Bobby Ghosh. Bobby, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think they've gotten back some of their money, not all of it. You don't move those sums of money so easily. Let's also remember that there were a lot of other U.S. sanctions on Iran that remained in place despite the nuclear deals, because those sanctions were not directly connected to Iran's nuclear activities. So Iran's access to these things to this money has not been as easy as all that. And in fact, that is part of a great deal of grievance within Iran. A lot of Iranians are very, very unhappy with their government right now, and there have been a string of demonstrations, low intensity but sustained demonstrations across the country, because the state of the economy is so bad. The Iranian rial, the Iranian currency, is in free fall. The economy is in very, very bad shape, and a lot of Iranians are asking the same question that your caller is saying, hey, we were supposed to have gotten all this money. You said we'd get all this money after we signed the deal. Where is that money, and why is that money not pouring into our economy? Why is it not being used to create jobs, to build infrastructure, to get our economy moving again? So there was a round number mentioned at the time, $100 billion that Iran in theory would have access to. In practice, I don't think they've gotten their hands on anything near that number.
Brian, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me just quickly reintroduce our guest. That's Bobby Ghosh. He's a journalist and commentator. He's written for Quartz, CNN, was the Baghdad bureau chief for Time during the Iraq War. Joining us, obviously, by telephone, Dominic Tierney with us in our Philadelphia studio, associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College. He's also a Templeton Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, located here in Philadelphia, and he's a contributing writer to The Atlantic. I do want to shift gears, but also give out that phone number again. It's 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, talking about two parts of the world, essentially two different countries, but linked by negotiations involving nuclear weapons. Let me play a clip. This is President Trump speaking on August 8th of 2017, and here he is talking about North Korea.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dominic, the news is that Kim Jong-un is talking about giving up his nuclear weapons program. He has sat down with the leader of South Korea. Apparently, he and Trump will meet at some place and at some time. Can we give the president credit for using this very incendiary, aggressive language? Clinton tried to do this. I mean, obviously, this hasn't happened yet. Obviously, Clinton, Bush, Obama tried to figure out some kind of deal related to nuclear weapons. Is Trump succeeding where they did not?
Well, I think the movie has a long way to go, and we're only in the early stages. So before we hand out any Nobel Peace Prizes to Trump or others, let's see how this turns out. After all, it was just a few months ago that North Korea was carrying out its sixth nuclear weapons test. It's largest that it's ever carried out. Its missile technology is far more advanced than we'd realized, and North Korea was either has or very close to the capability of hitting American cities with nuclear weapons. So things have moved very quickly, and there are reasons to be cautious, reasons to be hopeful. Reasons to be cautious would be that, to some extent, we've been here before.
We've been here before.
Yeah, there were negotiations, as you mentioned, under Clinton, the agreed framework in the 90s. They unraveled. There was also six-party talks under George W. Bush, where there were proclamations made by North Korea quite similar to today, and that unraveled. So there's reasons to be cautious. On the other hand, there is undoubtedly reasons to be optimistic. This is the first visit by a North Korean leader to South Korea since the Korean War. Critically, North Korea made some pretty strong statements about denuclearization that were then repeated explicitly on North Korean state television. And in addition to that, I was also struck not just by what Kim Jong-un said in South Korea, but also by what he didn't say. So he could quite easily have stated that any peace deal would require U.S. military withdrawal, the end of the U.S. alliance with South Korea, maybe even restrictions on American nuclear weapons, or these kind of claims. And he didn't really make any of those demands that would be essentially non-negotiable. So that also is a hopeful statement.
Can we trust Kim Jong-un, Bobby Ghosh?
It's very, very hard to trust that regime. They've done sort of 180-degree turns so often in the past. But you have to hope. And if the South Koreans are willing to trust them, then, you know, those are the people at the sharp end of the spear. They are the people most likely, most immediately to feel the wrath of North Korea. If they are willing to trust the North Koreans, I think it behooves the rest of us at least to hold our skepticism in check a little bit. As Dr. Terry probably pointed out, we've seen this movie before. I was a Time magazine editor in the Asian edition of Time in the year 2000, when there was a first summit between the leaders of the two Koreas. I remember the excitement then. One of the leader of South Korea actually got the Nobel Prize. There was a hug, there was a photograph, there was a cover story in Time magazine. It all seemed like a big breakthrough. And nothing came of it. And then in 2007, again, the two leaders met, the leaders of the two Koreas. And again, there was an explosion of hope. Sorry, that might not have been the best analogy.
No, that's all right. We'll forgive you that one. Yeah, go ahead.
but then that went nowhere either. The history teaches us to be very, very, very cautious. But the South Koreans who watch this much more closely than anybody, because it represents an existential threat to them, the South Koreans seem optimistic. And therefore, we have to, I think, hold our skepticism in check. The South Korean president is willing to give Donald Trump credit for this. And I think that needs to be taken seriously. Yes, I think Donald Trump's bellicose rhetoric has brought us where we are today, where there was a summit between the two Koreas. There is likely to be a summit between the president and Kim. These are not small things, but as Dr. Terry pointed out, we'll measure this in a year or 2 years from now, looking back to see what was actually achieved by all this summitry. And that's when we can begin to exhale, I think. Until then,
hold our breath.
I will be holding my breath.
Well, let's take a very short break and get back to our conversation. We are talking about two different parts of the world involving nuclear weapons and apparent deals involving nuclear weapons. Again, Bobby Ghosh joining us by telephone. He's a journalist and commentator. Dominic Tierney here with us in our Philadelphia studio, associate professor of political science at Swarthmore College. This is the world we live in. We want to hear from you folks. What do you make of these deals, the negotiations, the promises, the pronouncements? 1-888-477-9499. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and just to recap here, President Trump faces a pretty big decision next week on whether or not to reauthorize the Iran nuclear weapons deal. Meanwhile, thousands of miles away on the Korean Peninsula, talks are underway that could result in North Korea giving up its nuclear weapons program. That's, of course, a very big could. President Trump says he wants to meet with the North Korean leader. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, RadioTimes@WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation, trying to figure out what's going on in these parts of the world and how it matters to us. Dominic, you and I were chatting. We have that advantage because you're sitting here with us in our Philadelphia studio about why would Kim give up his nuclear weapons program?
I mean, it seems unlikely, right, because North Korea has invested so much in the program, given its very limited resources. And it is
bragged about it.
Right. It is so bound up with the regime's legitimacy and its brand, as it were, in the North. But he is now on record favoring denuclearization, although that's somewhat ambiguous phrase.
What does that mean?
Right. But why would he do this? Well, the obvious answer is that the sanctions and the pressure has worked. There has been a kind of good cop, bad cop routine with Trump as the bad cop and the South Koreans as the good cop. And the sanctions do seem to have hurt North Korea, in part because China has stepped up its enforcement of those sanctions on things like coal exports and oil imports into North Korea. Although it's not perfect. When Kim Jong-un visited China, the Chinese actually gave him hundreds of thousands of dollars of gifts, including jewelry and so on. And that's probably actually a violation of UN sanctions. But the reason we know they're hurting is, or at least an indicator, is there was a defector traveled to the south, quite an elite member of the regime. And when he was medically examined, they found uncooked corn in his stomach, suggesting that even for some senior people in the regime, conditions are pretty tough in the north. And, of course, Kim, I think, doesn't really care about necessarily the human rights of his population, but he does care about having the money and luxury goods to sort of keep his elite happy, because he cares more than anything about regime survival. And so it may be that he's determined that having enough luxury goods and money to sort of keep things stable is more important than the number of nuclear weapons he has.
Bobby Ghosh, you think if the U.S. Gets out of the deal with Iran involving their nuclear weapons program, do you think that would have any kind of impact on whatever happens as the president sits down with Kim?
It's hard to imagine that it would not have an impact. I don't think it automatically means Kim walks away from the negotiating table. But I think that he would demand to see some money up front for a start. His terms would become stiffer. And I think the other negotiating parties would take the lessons from the predicament that the Europeans find themselves with regard to the Iranian deal. So the Chinese, the Japanese, the South Koreans, all of whom will have a say on any deal with North Korea, will want to make sure that a future American president can't simply back away from it, because they will be in the neighborhood and they will care much more about the deal than the United States does. The United States' interest in the deal is very narrowly focused on denuclearization, which, to my mind, again, we're repeating the mistakes we saw with Iran by defining the outcome so narrowly. Yeah. But for China, for South Korea, for Japan, there are other more sort of immediate concerns that they would want to see. That would mean that they would want to see any deal made much stronger than the deal made with Iran, and much less likely to be broken by Donald Trump himself on a whim a couple of years from now, if he's still president, or by any future American president.
Let me see what David from Maple Glen has to say. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Great show.
Thank you.
I think this gets to the point that I was calling about, which is that, you know, people talk a lot in the media about the, whether North Korea can be trusted. And the real question, I think, in terms of whether him gets rid of his nuclear weapons, is whether he thinks the United States can be trusted. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we're backing out, it looks like, from the Iran deal. And he probably will insist at a minimum that the Senate approves whatever a deal is reached before they would even think about getting rid of their nuclear weapons. And secondly, you know, the U.S. has backed out of a lot of deals. It really betrayed Gaddafi by going in and helping to overthrow his regime after he had agreed to get rid of his nuclear plan. So for Kim, you know, unless he has nuclear weapons, he doesn't have real insurance that the U.S. won't turn around and do the same thing to him. So I think our experience is going to mean that he probably will not give up all these nuclear weapons.
David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Dominic, I'm going to toss that to you.
I think David makes a really excellent point there. The truth is, neither side trusts each other, and distrust is at the heart of this. And both sides could make a reasonable case for that distrust. And part of the problem is that they just don't understand each other, right? You have two completely alien societies in the form of North Korea, the Hermit Kingdom, the communist regime, and the United States. They don't even have formal diplomatic relations. And so the possibility of misperception and misunderstanding of the other side's acts, of, you know, interpreting what the other side does in the worst possible way, is extremely high. And one of the advantages of the Iran nuclear deal is that it was designed for countries that do not trust each other. That was the whole framework of the Iran nuclear deal is this is a deal for countries that do not have much trust. So it is based on very wide-ranging inspections and in some ways could be a model for moving forward with North Korea. Mm. Of course, the irony is we're about to tear up the Iran nuclear deal, even though it actually has, I think, a lot to offer.
Mistrust, but verify, right?
Exactly.
Bobby, this is getting ahead of ourselves here, but it's hard to imagine that North Korea, this so-called hermit kingdom, would allow inspectors in that country if whatever deal is negotiated is in any way like the deal with Iran.
Well, actually, North Korea has in strictly in terms of making a nuclear deal, North Korea is playing with a much stronger hand than the Iranians did. North Korea actually has nukes. It has tested them 6 times. That is as many times as India tested its nukes. That is as many times as Pakistan tested its nukes. And neither India nor Pakistan is interested in any further tests, so because they have demonstrated that they're nuclear power. So from the North Korean point of view, they are already a nuclear power. They have an arsenal of nuclear weapons. And therefore, when they come to the negotiating table, they can negotiate an incremental deal rather than, you know, we're going to give everything up right now, sort of an arrangement. And I think that would be okay with some of the other parties that are involved. I think South Korea would like to see a denuclearized peninsula, but they don't necessarily want to see that happen right away. They've got other priorities. Likewise, North Korea and likewise, China. I think both China and South Korea would be fine if North Korea said, we're going to give up our nuclear program on a calendar that's sort of 10 years from now, verifiable step by step. This is what we'll do next year. This is what we'll do the year after. This is what we'll do in 2024. It's only the United States and it's only the Trump administration that's saying, give up all your nukes right now. And so I think the negotiations will be quite complex because different parties have different priorities and different expectations. I think the North Koreans would be happy to have inspectors come. They've done that before too. A couple of years ago, they dismantled a cooling tower that was connected to the uranium program. They were promising the world that they were giving up their uranium program. They blew up the cooling tower. They had an American academic who was there to inspect it. They changed their minds afterwards and went back to their nuclear program. They have a history of doing that.
Well, the U.S. has no ambassador to South Korea. Dominic, I don't know if that's a problem or not going forward. And I wonder whether Kim is a more skilled negotiator and even whether he understands President Trump more than President Trump understands him. Again, getting into the heads of people here. But he's, you know, I think a couple of years ago, people thought he was young and he had this funny haircut and didn't seem to have a coherent policy. Can we say we're dealing with a different Kim?
Well, you know, he's a great unknown, enigmatic figure. He's aggressively threatened the United States and then recently went to South Korea and gave some very warm and fuzzy addresses.
Yeah.
He has achieved something which no North Korean leader has achieved, which is a face-to-face meeting with an American president. And that is a significant gain in terms of his global image. Whether he is a master calculator, whether he understands Trump and is, you know, going to stroke Trump's ego and try to get a deal that way, I don't know. My assumption is that if North Korea is a mystery to us, the Trump administration is an enormous mystery to the North Koreans.
They must, and to a lot of the world,
right,
I would say. Right.
Right, but they must sit around in Pyongyang and think, who is this guy? And what do we make of these tweets of fire and fury? And so if we sit here in the United States trying to decipher Trump, what do they do in Pyongyang?
Let me read an email for Julia, and Bobby, I'll put this to you. She says, while quite a bit of the discussion has been about Trump's role in the upcoming summit, don't you think the new South Korean government has bigger hands in bringing North Korea to the talks? Do you agree with that, Bobby?
I think they had a hand, whether it's a bigger hand or not, but they'll certainly have a much bigger role in what happens after the talks. If any deal is made or a process towards a deal has been agreed to, it'll then fall to the South Koreans to carry much of the burden going forward, I think. Remember that the North Koreans will only make a deal if they get something out of it. And what they want out of that is for the sanctions regime to go away and for economic goodies. And the countries that are willing to deliver those economic goodies essentially boil down to China and South Korea. And South Korea has the greatest interest in a prosperous or at least an economically viable North Korea. They are the ones who will be doing most of the investing, most of the aid giving. So I think, the South Koreans will play the major role once the summit is over. And that's how it should be, and that's how that would suit, the United States perfectly. Because whereas Trump definitely wants a deal with him, he doesn't then want to have to carry to pay the tab of fixing the Korean economy. He'd be very happy for the South Koreans and for China to collect the tab.
There was a report this morning, I think it was from The Independent, I'm looking at, North Korea is reported to have freed 3 detained Americans from a labor camp and moved them to a hotel near Pyongyang ahead of the planned meeting between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. I shared this with you, Dominic, before going on the air. Assuming that's true, how significant is that?
Well, it's another symbolic move in the cause of peace. There were many others. Kim and Moon grasped hands and stepped back into North Korea as part of the meeting. Right, that was symbolic. They planted a tree together. That was symbolic. I think North Korea has now moved back to the same time zone as South Korea. It actually deviated 30 minutes as an act of resistance. It's now said it's going back on the same time zone. So this is sort of a piece with that. It's positive, right? And certainly good news for the individuals involved and their families and so on. There's a human story here that's very important. But symbolic moves like this can be undone. North Korea can decide to capture Americans and so on just as easily as it can release them. So, again, it's good, but it's the start of the movie.
It's the start of the movie. You've made several movie references. How come?
Well, I just think we sometimes have a sort of short-term view of these things and you know, we're fixated on the drama of the moment. But these are issues which are very long and enduring issues which have years and decades to go and many, many twists and turns in the narrative. And again, one of the valuable things about this conversation is sort of thinking about Iran and North Korea and how they're connected, mm-hmm. because we tend to read about and think about these cases as very separate cases. You know, you read about Iran on one part of the New York Times website, and then you read about North Korea in another part, and the stories are very separate. But in fact, they're part of an integrated, bigger picture here, where each of the regimes is looking very closely at how the United States deals with the other regime to get signals about whether it should cooperate or not. And so you need to have the kind of holistic kind of global view.
Bobby, we're almost out of time. What will you be looking for in the next couple of weeks?
Well, obviously we'll know next weekend whether the president is pulling the United States out of the Iran deal. I'm paying very close attention, and I think Dr. Tierney hinted at this, I'm paying very close attention to how all of this has been communicated to the North Korean audience, how the North Korean media is covering this. Because Kim, his father, his grandfather, have, you know, for 3 generations, they've persuaded their own people through aggressive and sustained propaganda that having a nuclear program was crucial to their very existence and central to their national pride. It won't be easy for Kim to overnight change that, and he has to manage his own people's expectations. When he starts doing that, that's when I will begin to get a little more confident about what kind of outcome is possible. It's worth remembering that back in the day, that we only really began to trust Mikhail Gorbachev when he began to give his own people a break. It was not just his promise to reduce nuclear weapons.
I hate to do this. We are out of time. My thanks so much to both of you. Bobby Ghosh, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. Nice to have you back on the show. And Dominic Tierney, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and John Ahrens with Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.